From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the Department of Dirty Tricks, we talk with Evan Thomas, author of a new book about the men who ran the CIA's covert operations in the early years of the Cold War. His book is based in part on his exclusive access to the CIA's own classified history. Also, Telstar and other space-age recordings. Dennis Dykin of the Smithereens tells us why he's compiled a new anthology of recordings from the 60s made by the British record producer Joe Meek. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the second memoir by Mary Cantwell of the New York Times editorial board. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton and Russian President Boris Yeltsin are meeting in Franklin Roosevelt's old home in Hyde Park, New York. They hope to settle big differences over Bosnia and the expansion of NATO. Mr. Clinton's reportedly ready to compromise on provisions of a 1990 treaty with Russia, calling for cuts in NATO and former Warsaw Pact tanks, artillery, aircraft, helicopters, and armored vehicles by next month. The idea is to ease limits on Russia's northern and southern borders so it can easily deal with secessionist movements. California Governor and former presidential contender Pete Wilson has thrown his support to Senator Bob Dole. Wilson says Dole is the best general to lead the Republican Party in its efforts to evict Bill Clinton from the White House.
Bob Dole is a fighter for what he believes in. I admire that. And he's a winner. Bob Dole will be a winner for California and for America, and that is why I am enthusiastically endorsing him for President of the United States.
In return, Dole has named Wilson a national co-chairman of his campaign and the head of Dole's efforts in California.
The great team we're building in our largest state, in California, makes it clear that we believe returning California to the Republican column for president is tremendously important, both for my campaign and for our party. This demonstrates it will not be a repeat of what happened in 1992 when our party abandoned California.
Wilson folded his own presidential campaign less than a month ago. He's got $1.4 million in campaign debt. Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan is dropping his lawsuit against the U.S. Park Service. He'd sought to challenge the official count of marchers from last week's Million Man March. UPI's Jay Saper reports.
Farrakhan dropped his lawsuit after the Park Service acknowledged it may have undercounted marchers. Organizers fumed, and Farrakhan cried racism when the Park Service counted 400,000 marchers. A Boston University expert put the number closer to 1 million. Farrakhan's chief of staff says he's got pictures proving the crowd closer to 2 million. Leonard Mohammed said the Park Service acknowledged it has close-up photos that show a denser crowd. The Park Service stands by its count, but says it could be revised after the review process. Jay Saper, Chicago.
France is criticizing the United States for not paying its full bill to support the United Nations. The world's body is in the throes of a financial crisis. Washington owes about $1 billion. World leaders are gathering in New York for the UN's 50th anniversary. French President Jacques Chirac says the bill isn't acceptable, but balanced his criticism by agreeing with Washington the UN should be made leaner and more efficient. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 24 points. This is NPR. A jury is now deliberating the fate of the woman accused of murdering Tejano star Selena. Jim Bell of member station KUHF reports from Houston.
In his final arguments to the jury, defense attorney Fred Hagen said Selena was the victim of a tragic and terrible accident, not a murder. Hagen's told the jury that from start to finish, prosecutors and Corpus Christi police were confronted with a clearly accidental shooting, but for their own reasons, Hagen said they ignored it and even covered it up in their rush to make a murder case against Yolanda Saldivar. In prosecutors' final arguments, Assistant DA Mark Skirka said Saldivar deliberately and intentionally shot Selena because she couldn't stand the thought of being fired from her job and losing the lifestyle she had by being part of Selena's inner circle. If convicted, Saldivar could get anything from probation to life in prison. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Bell in Houston.
A new study finds that the national homicide rate has dropped. The National Center for Health Statistics says the homicide rate fell more than 8% from 1993 to 94. It's down for the eighth year in a row. Many of the nation's biggest cities are also feeling the drop. Detroit, Chicago, Los Angeles have seen downturns in their murder rates. New York officials expect to end the year with 48% fewer killings than they had in 1990. That year they set a record. It's not known what triggered the drop, but some authorities speculate it's due in part to a higher profile of police officers in high crime areas. Wells Fargo & Company says it's stepping up its effort to take over First Interstate BancCorp and will start buying up First Interstate stock. Wells wants to buy up to 4.9%, or about $500 million worth of First Interstate stock. Wells Fargo has already made a hostile takeover offer for First Interstate, and the deal's worth more than $10 billion. The size of the bid is a record for a bank merger. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As we begin to learn about the CIA's advances in the controversial territory of economic espionage, a new book has been published about the early years of CIA covert operations. This was the era when the CIA fought the Cold War with espionage, sabotage, and propaganda, and the agency plotted to get rid of unfriendly leaders through coups and assassinations. The new book, The Very Best Men, is about the men who led covert operations during the Cold War and about the culture they created within the CIA. The author, Evan Thomas, is Newsweek's assistant managing editor and Washington bureau chief. Thomas is the first journalist the CIA has permitted to read the CIA's own secret histories. Thomas says these classified histories were written by retired officers to be used as teaching tools so other officers could learn from the mistakes of the past. According to Thomas, there were plenty of them.
Oh, they screwed up just about everything they tried in the 1950s. They were amateurs at a professional game. Unfortunately, the other side, the communists, had 50 years of practice at running black operations, and they were better at it. For instance, we parachuted agents in behind the Iron Curtain into the East Bloc in the early 1950s. Every single one was captured or rolled up or turned by the Russians. There were no successes in this area, and they finally gave up.
Were there attempts at self-justification in these histories? Like, yes, this operation failed, but I know I was right in pursuing it.
There's a little bit of that. I mean, there is a feeling of, gee whiz, we did our best. We were up against a very difficult foe. We did the best we could. Sure, we failed, but we tried. There was a lot of that give it the old school try feeling at this time. There was also an enormous sense of urgency. We forget how scary the world looked in 1950. The Pentagon had a planning date, January 1st, 1952, for the Soviet invasion of Western Europe. I mean, we really thought the tanks were about to roll, and the feeling was, well, you got to do something. We didn't want to go to war with Russia because that meant nuclear weapons and conflagration, if not the end of the world. So the CIA was about the only thing going that could possibly stem the red tide, and we wanted to try to play the game their way by dirty tricks, by espionage and subterfuge and blackmail and bribery, all the tricks the KGB was so good at, just that we weren't quite as good as they were.
Actually, in your book, you describe what one of the plans was to prevent the Soviet invasion of Western Europe.
Well, we were going to drop all sorts of people behind the Iron Curtain to sabotage their airfields. None of that would have worked, I think. But those were the sort of plans we had. There were some, I don't want to be too critical here, because there were some good things we did. We would support these left, interestingly, you think of the CIA as being a reactionary force. It really was pretty liberal in the old days. And they would support various labor groups and student groups that were tend to be social democratic, tend to be left-leaning. They would buttress the idea of democracy against Soviet subversion. The Soviets were very busy starting their own student groups and farmers groups and labor groups. And there was kind of a war for the hearts and minds, particularly of the youth and the workers of Europe in the late 40s and 1950s. And the CIA did some constructive work in backing these front organizations. When this was exposed in the late 60s, it was all considered to be a terrible CIA plot, and how could the CIA possibly pay to subsidize magazines like Encounter or the Culture of, I think it was called the Congress of Cultural Freedom. They had various front groups. I am of the view that it wasn't such a bad idea, that there was a genuine competition, and it wasn't such a bad thing to have the West strengthen these institutions that backed democracy and freedom. That part worked pretty well. The part that didn't work was paramilitary operations, trying to foment rebellion behind the Iron Curtain, running agents behind the Iron Curtain. All that was a big mess.
Did you have an idea of what the focus of your book would be when you first started to read the CIA histories?
Really, I was looking at a personal drama here. I wrote an earlier book with Walter Isaacson called The Wise Men about the old foreign policy establishment. And when I was researching that book, that was about figures like George Kennan and Chip Bolin, Dean Acheson, Averill Harriman, I became intrigued with one of their social friends, a man named Frank Wisner. Frank Wisner started the Department of Dirty Tricks. He's just the clandestine service for the CIA in the late 40s. And he later shot himself. He was a tragic Cold War suicide. And I thought, boy, I bet you there's a yarn in here. So I started looking at Wisner's life, and that led me to the life of my three other characters as well, all of whom ran the clandestine service, or in Barnes's case, in one of the cases was a deputy, but all who were prominent figures running the Department of Dirty Tricks in the early years, and all of whom shared a certain social background. They were all well-to-do, well-educated, prep school and Ivy League types, and all of whom had a very similar mindset, very confident, we can lick this, we can overcome communism, America's the greatest country, and we can do anything we want.
What connection do you think there is between the Ivy League background, the fact that there are so many people that these people hired who are former Wall Street lawyers? What connection is there between that and the types of tactics that they used in covert operations?
Well, it's incongruous in a way, and this is one of the riddles that I try to explore in my book. Places like Groton and Yale supposedly teach fair play and muscular Christianity and choosing the harder right over the easier wrong. So what were people like that doing, experimenting with blackmail, espionage, bribery, assassination? It is incongruous. And the answer lies in the enormous sense of confidence that these men felt. We had won World War II. It was exciting. It was dramatic. A lot of these Ivy Leaguers just went back to their law firms and their banks. But some of them had a great taste to do something more fulfilling and more dramatic. And there was a kind of a cowboy breed of Ivy Leaguer that could afford to stay in government service, and was attracted to the CIA, where the only weapons at their disposal to fight communism were these dirty tricks. And it was an unnatural act for them. They had all the confidence in the world to try to take on the Soviet Union, but they were using tools that they really weren't trained to use. There was a kind of naivete and gullibility amongst these Ivy Leaguers. They were not brought up to run black ops. Groton School does not teach you how to blackmail people. Working for the KGB does, and that's why they had so many failures. But they brought this enormous kind of enthusiasm and optimism and feeling that they could do anything that really was a kind of, well, the Greek word for it is hubris. They had this kind of overweening arrogance.
So whatever the spy equivalent of street smarts is, these guys didn't have it?
They didn't. A top guy in British MI6, the British Secret Intelligence Service, named John Bruce Lockhart, who was the real-world Smiley of John le Carré books, Lockhart told me that these men were innocents. He used that word, innocent. They had a kind of gullibility and naivete about them that in the end was their undoing.
Well, let me see. Do you think that the CIA involvement with the mafia in the attempts to assassinate Castro is a good example of this lack of street smarts?
The best. I mean, it's absolutely loony when you think of Richard Bissell, who went to Groton and Yale, was a Yale economics professor, a brainy intellectual who grew up in fancy drawing rooms. Richard Bissell hiring Johnny Rosselli of Las Vegas and Sam Momo Giancana of Chicago to try to assassinate Fidel Castro just blows your mind. I mean, it's way out there. And there's no good explanation for it except that Bissell was a tremendous risk taker. He thought a little bit too logically. His logic said, well, gee, the mafia are the professional hitmen. Why not hire the professionals to do this job? It all backfired. They didn't, in the end, as the congressional investigators said in the 70s when they were looking into all this, the CIA was the gang that couldn't shoot straight. They never did kill anybody. They hired the mob, but the mob killed nobody.
Did Bissell write a history that you were able to read of the CIA involvement with the mafia?
Bissell, when I came upon Bissell, he was writing his own memoirs. He had just turned 80, and he was writing his own history of what happened. I was given access to those memoirs, which have not been published yet. They will be published by the Yale University Press next year. And I spent a great deal of time interviewing Bissell as he was writing his memoirs, which was useful for me because he had just been sort of immersed in all of his past and was able to recreate it for me verbally, just telling me what he was writing.
So what were you able to learn from talking to him about the logic behind going in with the mafia?
Well, you know, it's funny. He said he had no moral regrets. He was very emphatic about that. He had no sort of chagrin that he'd done anything evil or immoral. His regret was that it hadn't worked. He felt silly and foolish that he had been duped by the mob and that the mob hadn't succeeded. As for his motivations, he said, look, I thought that people like Castro and Lumumba, two of his targets, were mad dogs. This was an urgent time. It was in the interest of the United States to get rid of these people. You know, after all, in World War II, we would have thought nothing of trying to assassinate Hitler. We did assassinate Yamamoto, the senior Japanese admiral. And it was assassination was an acceptable tool, as he put it, of international rivalry. He didn't like to use the word assassination, interestingly. He called it executive action. And there was about him, I thought, a kind of unspoken reticence about this. He claimed he had no regrets, but when he began talking about assassination, he became very formal and ponderous and rather unlike himself. And I strongly suspected that he harbored some personal doubts that he was just too stiff upper lip to reveal.
Did you learn anything new about what the plan was?
I learned a few details. One plot he told me about, and this is a bit grotesque, it was to give Sukarno, the president of Indonesia, a case of VD by getting an airline stewardess giving her a dose of bad clap, basically, and getting her to give it to Sukarno. This is all pretty crude. They never actually carried this out. It was a plan. And it, typically, Bissell was very euphemistic about it. He described this plot to give VD to an airline stewardess to pass to Sukarno as a plan to biologically immobilize Sukarno through the use of a female associate.
Wow.
I mean, that
shows
you
any regard for the stewardess and her health?
No. There was a double standard here. These men tended to be gentlemen towards other gentlemen. This is very British. Paul Nitze, who's an old Cold Warrior, explained this to me. Fair play, the rules of fair play apply to other gentlemen. He went back to the Greeks. Greeks were fair to other Greeks, but to barbarians, to their enemies, dirty tricks were perfectly okay. So it was one thing to double-cross your clubmates or your schoolmates. It was quite another to double-cross the Hottentots or the Fuzzy-Wuzzies. The British had a long tradition of being harsh and repressive and ruthless to native tribes in Africa or in Asia or in India, and this was a mindset that the CIA leaders had as well. They were careless with third world lives.
Evan Thomas is my guest. His new book is called The Very Best Men, Four Who Dared, The Early Years of the CIA. Let's take a break and then we'll talk about the CIA some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Evan Thomas, his new book, The Very Best Men, is about the early years of the CIA, particularly covert operations. And Thomas is assistant managing editor of Newsweek, as well as Newsweek's Washington bureau chief. Getting back to the CIA and the mafia and the plot to assassinate Castro, did you learn anything new about that plot and that collaboration?
Not really. Most of that has been pretty well brought out. I mean, only in the United States would we have a full public record of the Central Intelligence Agency's darkest plots. This came about because of Watergate. After Watergate, journalists started picking up the rock that was the United States government and looking to see what was underneath. And one of the things that was underneath were these CIA plots using the mafia to kill foreign leaders. The Church Committee in 1975 did a pretty thorough investigation, and the CIA, to his credit, Bill Colby, who was then the head of the CIA, turned over what were known as the family jewels. The family jewels were all the dark and dirty tricks of the CIA, or most of them at least, over the years, and those were given to congressional investigators and for the most part made public. I learned of a few new details from Bissell. There was recently declassified a Inspector General's report from 1967 that has some more details, but the basic plots were laid out publicly in the mid-70s, and in fact are the basis now for a lot of the wacky conspiracy theories that Americans have about the CIA. Did you know that half of the people in the United States believe that the CIA had a role in killing John F. Kennedy? I think they believe that in part because of these nutty plots surfaced in the mid-70s.
Did you see any evidence of that in your histories that you read?
No, I really looked into this question because Desmond Fitzgerald, one of my characters, was running the Cuban operations when Kennedy was killed. And on the day Kennedy was shot, one of Fitzgerald's operatives was handing a poison pen to a Cuban operative in Paris for use against Castro. It was never used. Various conspiracy theorists have gone, aha, there has to be something sinister here about the CIA running all these plots against Castro and Kennedy's death. Various people have said that crazy Cubans who were linked to the mafia, who had CIA connections. I mean, there are millions of theories about this. I looked at this pretty hard. You cannot find any hard evidence. You find some tantalizing links, distant but tantalizing links, but you can't find anything that you could even begin to call hard evidence that would link the CIA to Kennedy's death. I personally don't believe it. I know the character of these men. The last thing they would do is get involved in killing John F. Kennedy. They liked John F. Kennedy. He was good to them. I suppose it's possible that the mafia did it. I suppose it's possible that sort of disaffected Cubans who had some CIA ties did it. But again, I don't think the evidence is there, Oliver Stone's movie notwithstanding.
You know, getting back to Castro for a second, there were all these attempts to embarrass him. The CIA was thinking of putting a woman's depilatory powder in Castro's shoes so that his beard would fall out, and since his beard was so symbolic, that would embarrass him. There was a scheme to contaminate the air of a radio station that he was speaking in with aerosol spray of LSD, so he'd say stupid, embarrassing things on the air and in public. I mean, looking back, I mean, do you think those schemes seem a little silly?
Well, it's even sillier. I mean, let me tell you about the genesis of those schemes. On March 13th, 1960, there was a dinner party in Georgetown. And Otsi Leiter, a well-known Georgetown hostess, had, as her guest, Ian Fleming, who was the author of James Bond novels. Mm-hmm. He was at work on Thunderball at the time. The other guests were John F. Kennedy, senator from Massachusetts, Joe Alsup, a famous sort of WASPy columnist in Georgetown, and John Bross, who is a senior official at the Central Intelligence Agency, very close to two of my heroes in my book, Bissell and Barnes. The conversation turned to Castro, what to do about Castro, who was new on the scene and causing trouble. And Ian Fleming, the author of James Bond novels, said, the thing to do about Castro is to humiliate him, make him look ridiculous. They believe in virility in Cuba. Make his beard fall out. Well, the next morning, Otsi Charles told me this, this hostage, she got a phone call from none other than Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA, asking where Mr. Fleming was and could he come down to Langley. It may or may not be a coincidence that at just about exactly the same time, according to the CIA's own Inspector General's report, the CIA began plotting with a plot to make Castro's beard fall out by putting a women's depilatory. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
Depilatory.
Mm-hmm. Depilatory is what makes your hair fall out, on your legs or something.
Well, they were going to put it in Castro's boots when he left him outside his hotel room on a trip to Chile in the spring of 1960. Like most CIA plots, this was never carried out, but they just kept on going. The next plot was to make impregnate cigars, Castro likes cigars, still does, with an hallucinogen to make him crazy. And the next idea was to put a poison in the cigars to hand out those cigars and various other pills and potions. Richard Bissell hired the mafia.
So you think it's possible that some of these dirty tricks are actually inspired by the creator of James Bond?
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's hilarious, but I think it's no doubt it's true.
Your book goes back to the very beginning of the CIA's covert operations. In fact, you say that early on, really, the Pentagon didn't want responsibility for covert operations. The State Department didn't want responsibility for covert operations. And the covert operations even had just a tenuous hook to the CIA early on. Why didn't anybody want it?
No state wants to be held responsible for dirty tricks, for blackmail or bugging or black bag jobs or all the black arts. Certainly not for so-called wet affairs, including assassination. What they want is became known as the doctrine of plausible deniability, which means that government can order up actions and dirty tricks, but the policymakers, particularly the president, want to be able to deny it, to say, hey, I had nothing to do with that. And that's why there is no paper trail at all leading to a lot of these plots. There's been a furious debate for two decades about whether or not various presidents authorized assassinations and other dirty tricks. The record is murky because nobody wrote this down and everybody's running for cover on it. My own view is that it worked this way, and I got this largely from talking to Bissell, who was the principal action officer here. A president would say something like, boy, that Castro, he's a bad guy. We got to get rid of him. Or he wouldn't even say we've got to get rid of him. He would say, that Castro, he's an awful guy. His national security advisor would say, yeah, we got to take strong measures. That was all the license that the CIA needed in those days to begin concrete plotting, assassination plotting, or psychological warfare to humiliate and discredit a foreign leader. They did not need explicit authorization. And this goes back to the question of their character and their worldview. These were supremely confident men who believed they could do whatever they wanted. They didn't need a whole lot of... They weren't scared or timid bureaucrats. They didn't need to cover their own rear ends with memos or documents. They basically felt, hey, the president wants us to get rid of Castro, we will.
So you're confident that the presidents often didn't know what the CIA was up to?
Because they didn't want to know. I think the Kennedys certainly became aware that the CIA was messing around in this area. I don't think Eisenhower knew, but I'm guessing a little bit here. And there's a sort of a willful denial. I think that Eisenhower and Kennedy had a CIA precisely to do this kind of thing, and they didn't really want to know what the CIA was doing. It was willful.
Evan Thomas is the author of The Very Best Men, about the early days of the CIA. Thomas is the assistant managing editor of Newsweek. He'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from Hyperion, publisher of Chain of Evidence, the new book from Ridley Pearson. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the story of the eccentric British record producer Joe Meek, who made Telstar, Have I the Right, and lots of British hits in the 60s that never made it to America. We'll talk with Dennis Dykin of the Smithereens, who's put together a collection of Meek's productions. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Manhattan When I Was Young, the second memoir by Mary Cantwell.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Evan Thomas, author of the new book, The Very Best Men, about the early days of the CIA and the men who ran the agency's covert operations. Since part of your book is about the culture of the CIA and how that culture was developed by people from an Ivy League background, a very privileged background, tell us something about Frank Wisner's background. He, again, was the head of the first post-war covert operations office.
Frank Wisner was a Mississippian of a special kind. His family built this little town in Mississippi, owned the town, built the library, the parks, the schools, everything. And he grew up sort of like the analogy would be to a young British lord, that he was a feudal society down there. And he was sent off, like a young gentleman should be, to the University of Virginia, where he also went to law school. And then he made his way to Wall Street. And he grew up with this great sense of privilege and also morality. I think one of the reasons why he went mad and shot himself was that he couldn't reconcile the sense of right and wrong he was taught as a boy with the kind of ambiguities and moral ambiguities he had to deal with as a CIA chieftain.
So he was somebody who grew up with people serving him. Wait, I mean, you say he didn't even dress himself. He had a maid
to
dress him.
Yeah, he had great detail. Well, he dressed himself in the morning by holding up his hands and his arms, and a black maid would put his clothes on. This gives
you
a certain sense
out?
Of entitlement.
Yeah, how'd you find that out?
His niece told me this. I stayed with her down in Jean Lindsay down in Laurel, Mississippi. I went down there and visited the house where he grew up and talked to his various cousins and nephews and just tried to get a feel for his background.
When Frank Wisner headed covert operations, he would use the expression, the mighty Wurlitzer.
The mighty Wurlitzer.
What did he mean by that?
This is a giant organ that he could play all over the world to manipulate the world. The various components were psychological warfare, disinformation, planting newspaper articles to discredit the communists, handing out bribes to police chiefs or colonels in the army. It was this idea of America as this all-ruling force, but doing it secretly. Wisner would sit at his mighty Wurlitzer, hit all the keys and stops, and play pretty much any music he wanted. This was an illusion. It was a grandiose illusion. Wisner, in fact, was manic depressive, and I think he had this thought when he was on one of his highs.
Reading the CIA histories, did you get a sense of whether his mood affected his work?
Oh, I think so. I can't get into his brain chemistry, but there was certainly an element of manic high, of grandiose ambition about his plots. He wanted to, he wanted to overthrow the communist government of Albania, and he kept parachuting in agents and sending them arms long after it was clear that all of these agents had been turned by the security service in Albania and were actually spying for the communists. It was just one prolonged disaster, but he sort of couldn't stop himself. He just kept believing that it was all going to work out in the end. When it didn't, it was crushing to him. His downfall came in Hungary in 1956. After all these years of trying to stir up a revolution behind the Iron Curtain, the Hungarians actually did revolt in 1956. Wisner went out there. The problem was that the United States, having gotten the Hungarians on their tippy toes, were not about to go in and really intervene and really give them arms because the Eisenhower administration didn't want to start World War III. So Wisner went out there, standing on the border as all these Hungarian refugees are streaming across, and they would say, well, you know, where are the American parachutists? Where are the tanks? Where are the supplies? All we saw were Russian tanks. And it was many, many people died in the very fierce Russian crackdown. There was no help from the United States. And this was a humiliating, crushing experience for Wisner. He became basically blithering after several days of this. There was a scene that the Rome station chief told me about of him going to see when he went to Rome after this, going to see Claire Booth Luce, who was then the American ambassador to Rome, and Wisner just broke down and wept with her.
Is that part of the reason why he left covert operations?
He was finally basically drummed out. He went mad and became utterly irrational, started making no sense. There is one story I don't believe is true, that they took him out in a straitjacket, but it is definitely true that CIA doctors had to escort him out of the CIA and to a mental hospital in Baltimore where he was given shock therapy, became increasingly depressed, and finally shot himself.
Was that covered up? It's a frightening thought that the person heading covert operations was going mad and needed shock therapy.
I mean, can you imagine the headlines today and on NPR or on the New York Times if the head of the clandestine service had gone mad and needed shock therapy? But that was a different era. The press didn't poke around on that. Some reporters knew about it. Joe Alsup knew about it. But he was protective. Frank Wisner was his friend. The press was much more protective. Congress was very much hands-off. It was just a different era.
Was the CIA shaken up by that?
Oh, sure. It was, I mean, cataclysmic. You can imagine what it was like to see your boss be essentially carried out as a nut. They closed ranks. Richard Helms, who later became the director of Central Intelligence and was a much more careful and bureaucratic figure, basically pulled things together for a couple of years, or for about a year. But, you know, the CIA kept barreling right along. The next head of the clandestine service was Richard Bissell, the fellow who hired the mafia. So it didn't, it slowed them down for about a step, but basically they resumed their tremendously ambitious aims abroad, and the next great step was the Bay of Pigs, which was, as you know, a disaster.
Evan Thomas is my guest. He's the author of the book, The Very Best Men, Four Who Dared the Early Years of the CIA. And it focuses on about 15 years worth of covert operations in the CIA and the men responsible for them. Your book is in part about the culture of the CIA. How would you compare the culture now with the culture of the 50s and 60s, the period you write about?
There is some overhang. The preppies are gone. You won't find too many Groton or Yale boys in the CIA today. They're mostly state school, more middle class types. But the culture of secrecy and elitism does live on. And one of the reasons why the CIA got themselves in trouble with Aldrich Ames was they were so insular, so unto themselves, that they really couldn't see that they had a mole in their midst. And they didn't want anybody sort of looking over the wall to examine them, and that insularity was fatal in the case of Ames. That is a hangover from the old days. The social graces have gone, but the sort of sense of clubbiness remains.
Your book is largely based on the access that you had to CIA histories written by CIA men, and you were the first journalist to get access to these. Will other journalists have access to them now?
No, the CIA is very ad hoc and arbitrary. It took me 2 years and many thousands of dollars in legal fees to work out the arrangement that I did. And my the officer over there was handling me when it was over said, "We are never, ever going to do this again." It was just too hard, too painstaking. I think what will happen over time is they will gradually declassify big chunks of information and that will come out. Other historians can try to go my route, and they hope they do, but they should know that it's expensive and it's difficult, and the CIA is, you know, hard to deal with, and they won't get everything they want or won't even get close to everything they want. I think the best hope is that the executive branch, that the president pushes the CIA and Congress pushes the CIA to just declassify great chunks of documents. You know, the truth is there are no secrets in them anymore that would harm the national security. And, in fact, the most important wedge I used to get what I did get was that just that statement. There's nothing in here to harm the national security. And that's true. This is, the Cold War's over. This happened a long time ago. However, the tradition of secrecy dies hard, and the CIA doesn't want to give up its secrets.
What are some of the questions you still have about the CIA?
Well, you know, I don't think we know everything. I know that Seymour Hersh is at work on a book where he's looking at Joe Kennedy. We may find that that President Kennedy, through his father, had ties to the mafia that also entangled the CIA. I think there may even be more here to learn. I like to think that it's all in my book, but I'm not naive enough about history to think that you can ever get it all in one gulp. I've gotten further than other historians because I had more access, and because these old spooks are talking at the end of their lives about their careers. But, you know, there are always more secrets out there. This is a spooky, weird world, and it won't shock me if we don't find even stranger things than trying to make Castro's beard fall out as time goes on.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was fun.
Evan Thomas is the author of The Very Best Men, about the early days of the CIA. He's assistant managing editor and Washington bureau chief at Newsweek. This is Fresh Air. Joe Meek was an eccentric British record producer who passed on the chance to record an unknown band called the Beatles. Aside from that, his track record was pretty good. 45 of his records made the top 50 in England. Two of those records were hits in the U.S., Telstar in 1962 and Have I the Right in 64. Now we can hear those and the hits that never made it to America, oddball records that reflect Meek's preoccupations with the spirit world, outer space, horror, and Buddy Holly. The new anthology of his recordings was compiled by my guest Dennis Dykin of the American band The Smithereens. Meek created cheap special effects to generate the otherworldly sounds he wanted for his records, records such as this tribute to the first communications satellite, Telstar. Dennis Dykin, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Now, a lot of our listeners will remember Telstar from when it was a hit in 62 and 63. What makes this record special to you now?
I think right off the bat, what's special about it is that it holds up extremely well. It was a very unusual record in its day, and I think it's still very unusual in the same way, you know, with the passing of time and advances, quote-unquote, in technology and so forth, and with all the changes in popular music, I think Telstar by the Tornadoes is as delightfully unusual and bizarre and beautiful as it was back in, upon its release in October of 62.
What's the lead instrument on this? It sounds kind of like a guitar and kind of like a synthesizer. I can't quite place it.
Actually, it's a small battery-operated keyboard called a clavioline. It's a French invention, and it's a monophonic instrument, which means you cannot play chords on it. You can only play a single note at a time. And it had a lot of different settings and sounds you could get from it. Pretty much the forerunner of the synthesizer, you can say. First started out as a battery-operated unit, then later became transistorized.
Did Joe Meek break a lot of rules in the studio?
He certainly did. You got to understand, in the 50s and early 60s in Britain, all the engineers and producers wore white lab coats to work. And it was a very strict and staid type of situation. And Joe just came in and just did things his way and would strong-arm people that opposed him. He would use any of his own devices, to his own homemade echo units and compressors. And another thing that Joe did on his records that wasn't really done prior to his work was a very pronounced upfront drum sound. The British records of the time were very boomy and roomy sounding, and he brought the drums to the foreground with close mic drums. They were very often just mic'd from above or just in the room somehow, but he would go to great lengths to make the drum sound very upfront. And of course, this is pretty prevalent today.
Now, I want to play another Joe Meek production that I think Americans will be familiar with. This is The Honeycombs and Have I the Right?
Have I the right to hold you? You know I've always told you that we must never. Yeah.
Okay, that record was made in the summer of 64. Where does this fit into Joe Meek's world?
I think a lot of people will remember this record when they hear it. It was a big hit in the summer and into the fall of 64. And one of the standout characteristics of the single was the stomping on the chorus.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, listening back to it, I never remembered it being so boomy.
Yeah. Well, Joe's records, for the most part, had a real pronounced low end, and he got that in a lot of different ways in the studio. In this particular case, he had the Honeycombs line up on the stairwell after they recorded the basic track and had them stomp, overdub a group stomp on the record. And, he would use anything and everything to get what he wanted.
This is all really low tech, wasn't it? I mean, didn't he record out of his home?
That's right. He had a studio slash apartment, or an apartment slash studio above a leather goods shop in the Holloway Road section of London. And the quarters were pretty small. He had the main studio room, and right next to that was the control room. But if he couldn't fit the whole performing unit in the studio room, he would sequester the string section or the horns, sometimes actually on the stairwell or downstairs in the living room, his own living room, or for echo effect in the bathroom. And he didn't work with cue lights or talkback monitors, so he would just yell down the stairs or around the corner ready when another take was ready to be done.
He sounds like such an eccentric. Was he taken seriously within the British recording industry?
Well, he was, because he was successful, you see. In the mid-50s, all the records you would hear on the British charts sounded pretty much the same. They were characterized by a large, roomy sound, and the producers and engineers didn't stray too much from the rule book. And most of the records sounded pretty much like a cookie-cutter process. But Joe Meek came along and took the front skin off of a kick drum and the bass drum and stick a mic inside of that and used different ideas for miking giving a bigger bottom end to a lot of his records and using distortion, which was unheard of. And these things are all pretty commonplace these days. But back then, he was really throwing the rule book away. And at first there was people in the industry were looking at this and frowning upon it, but he proved to be successful. So people were starting to follow his way of doing things.
He had a tragic ending. What happened?
Yeah, Joe Meek eventually killed himself on February 3rd, 1967. And let me just backtrack a little bit. I did mention that he had this obsession, really, with Buddy Holly, so much that in 1957, I suppose it was, or early 58, through a seance, predicted Buddy Holly's death. Now, Buddy Holly died on February the 3rd, 1959. Joe Meek predicted it to be on February the 3rd, 1958. Rather strange, but he cornered Buddy backstage at a British concert in 1958 after the fact, just to let him know about it, I guess to assure him that everything was okay because February 3rd, 58 had passed. But as it turned out, he did die on that day a year later. For whatever reason, I don't know why Joe chose that day aside from I don't know why he chose to kill himself on the anniversary of Buddy Holly's death, but in fact he did. There were a lot of factors leading up to his demise. The hits stopped coming. He was having money problems. And he was gay, and in his day that was presented problems for him. And he was arrested for publicly importuning. And a lot of this was coming down on him, and his use of barbiturates, and who knows what other things were attached to it. Some people said he was dealing with black magic. I don't know. I wasn't there. But a lot of different pressures were mounting up, and he ended up, on the morning of February 3rd, 67, summoning up his landlady from the leather goods shop downstairs, having a bit of a shouting match with her. She tried to calm him down. She turned around to go down the stairs back to her shop, and he shot her dead and turned the gun on himself moments later.
Dennis Dykin is a member of the band The Smithereens. He produced a new CD called It's Hard to Believe It, The Amazing World of Joe Meek, on Razor and Tie Records. This is a tribute to Buddy Holly, produced by Joe Meek, recorded in 1961 by Mike Berry and the Outlaws. Whoa.
But his songs will always be remembered. Always.
This is Fresh Air. Mary Cantwell is a member of the editorial board of the New York Times, a former managing editor at Mademoiselle, and the author of a well-received memoir, American Girl, which recounts her childhood in Bristol, Rhode Island. But in the early 1950s, Cantwell was just another bright young thing who dreamed of becoming a writer. In her second memoir, Manhattan When I Was Young, Cantwell recalls those years spent in what she clearly believes is the most exhilarating city on earth. Book critic and native New Yorker Maureen Corrigan has a review.
In the prologue to Manhattan When I Was Young, Mary Cantwell tells us, "I have a remarkable memory for objects. Unlike many such boasts made by other autobiographers, this one happens to be true. Cantwell's memory is a yawning La Brea tar pits where the ephemera of bohemian chic New York life during the 50s and 60s lies suspended in its original state. She summons up wallpaper waist dresses, a cooking device called a rotissomat, and the young homemaker's shop in vanished department stores like B. Altman's. With few exceptions, the people who hustle through the Gray Bar building and the plaza alongside the young Cantwell are dwarfed by their surroundings, which is how you know this is a great New York memoir. It gets the proportions right." With her college roommate, Allie, Cantwell arrived in a 1950s Paradise Lost version of New York, where jobs and apartments were easy to find. She quickly landed a secretarial job at Mademoiselle, missing infamous guest editor Sylvia Plath by only a month or so. But as Cantwell recalls, there were still plenty of neurotics in residence. In fact, Mademoiselle in Vogue, where Cantwell later became a feature writer, sound a lot like the asylum in Marat Sade. After a day of mishigas at Mademoiselle, Cantwell would retreat to the basement apartment she shared with Allie on Waverly Place. "We lived in Greenwich Village," she admits, "because we had heard of it." Out of such accidents, a life is constructed. Cantwell has lived in the village ever since. Her one move out of the neighborhood was occasioned by her marriage to a literary agent she identifies only as B. Cantwell, a shy Irish Catholic girl, was attracted to B's Jewish intellectual intensity. She hilariously recounts the suspiciously pink gatherings B took her to in Lower East Side apartments where Woody Guthrie held court. This was the summer of the Rosenbergs, and Cantwell was afraid she'd be jailed just for being in the company of left-leaning Jews. Given the fact that she and B eventually divorced, this autobiography would seem to be Cantwell's opportunity to get even for all those hours spent at commie hootenannies and trying to read The Tropic of Cancer at B's urging. "I tried, I really tried," Cantwell tells us, "but he might as well have asked me to dash a communion wafer to the floor." Her account of their relationship, however, is infused with empathy and longing, so much so you find yourself rooting for the couple to give it one more try, 3 decades after the split. Despite all she's achieved, it's clear Cantwell believes one of the most special things that ever happened to her is that she became a New Yorker. Manhattan, and particularly the Village, have had many magical chroniclers, but there's always need for another, like Cantwell, who can conjure up Washington Square on a quiet summer afternoon, or Jane Street on a gusty day with the smell of the Hudson and the nearby garbage pier mingling on the wind. Recalling her first landlord on Jane Street, a sentimental old Irishman named Matty, Cantwell says, "The Village was to him what my hometown, Bristol, Rhode Island, was to me, a place where the streets were as thronged with the dead as with the living." After 40 years in Manhattan, Mary Cantwell, no longer young, has earned, like Matty, her own elegiac reckoning with the living and the dead. Thus a Joycean shadow falls faintly and faintly falls upon these pages. For an Irish Catholic girl who dreamt of being a writer, that is not at all a bad shade in which to bask.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Manhattan When I Was Young by Mary Cantwell. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Alan Tu, and Naomi Person, with Kathy Wolf and Joan Tui Westman. Research assistance from Rena Bander. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.